Dr. Mark Knight.
Yep.
I'll have to put that in. I reckon a good place to start would be transforming the Trent Valley is probably our first port of call, just to explain what your work is there at the moment in regards to that, and then we'll dive on to other bits a bit later.
Okay. Yeah, all right. So transforming the Trent Valley is it's a partnership scheme that, my part of it, I'll just stick with my part, is I'm the cultural heritage officer for that, and that means that I talk to landowners and other interested parties who've got historic monuments or heritage assets on their land, and that could be private landowners like farmers, or it could be East Staffs Borough Council, or anybody really, is one prong of it. The other one is, because this was set up largely by Staffordshire County Council and Historic England, and all my aspect of the project was, and they want to ensure that pillboxes from the Second World War are reused and looked after, so they'll be repurposed for the 21st century. So for example, we are, the week after next, we will be converting several pillboxes for bat hibernacula, so bats have got somewhere to roost along the Trent Valley. Or there'll be some that are converted for wild bird and swallow nests. But eventually we will link a whole section of the Trent with the River Dove, from where the River Tame comes in at Olrowis, up to the River Dove. There'll be, all those pillboxes will be converted for wildlife use and or geocaching and interpretation. So when the Trent Valley Way opens, that our section opens in, I think, this year in September, there'll be also information boards along the way saying what this pillbox is, because a lot of people don't know what they are. You know, they're Second World War bunkers in the event of an enemy invasion.
Yeah.
And using the sort of the landscape, in this case the River Trent, as a stop point to prevent the enemy getting further into the West Midlands. So Britain was compartmentalised by the War Office, and our section of it has got a load of these bunkers that were there to, in the event of an invasion, prevent the enemy crossing the river or slow them down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's good that they're being
repurposed for a new life.
Yeah.
For something positive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's amazing. So where does the doctor come from? Because that's reasonably recent, isn't it?
Yeah. I finished my doctorate, and you go to a live examination where you have to defend your thesis. I did that last June, so that was June 21, and I was awarded on the back of some, nobody ever says yes, well done, you've passed.
Yeah,
you know, there's always some kind of modification that you have to make. Mine weren't that large, luckily. It was, you know, odd grammatical errors, little bits and bobs, getting things just tidied up and neatened up so that I could submit it, and I was awarded it on my dad's birthday.
Wow.
June the 22nd last year. Yeah. So that's in history. So I'm a doctor of history.
Not bad, is it?
6 years hard work, though. You know, it's not easy.
Yeah.
Somebody was asking me about it the other day, saying, you know, what would you say about it? I'd say, if you've got the patience and the tenacity to get through it, then yeah, go for it. Yeah. It's just, however hard you think it's going to be, it's going to be harder than that.
Wow. Yeah.
You've got no concept at the start of how hard it's going to be.
Mm. What was your thesis around, if it's easy to nutshell it?
The development of the National Forest and the effective agency of trees in the English Midlands.
Yeah.
So and by agency of trees, I'm talking about how they affect people's mindset, how they affect, and how they have an agency in the world, how trees can act on the world in a way, obviously they're non-human, but how they still have an agency in the world that we normally only ascribe to us, you know, that we can make things change. But trees do that naturally on their own. As you know, anybody who knows even a little bit about being outside knows that you feel different when you're in natural spaces, and that those natural spaces have an effect on you, as well as you can, you know, have an effect on them by, I don't know, digging a garden, cutting a tree down, whatever it might be. But those spaces have an effect on your mental well-being, and I think your physical well-being as well.
I mean,
I don't go into too much detail about that in the thesis. It was more about the transformation of communities over the last 25 or 30 years since with the advent of the National Forest and the change to the, you know, on a landscape scale, the changes that we found across the area.
Because we talk about the transition from black to green, don't we, in our local area quite a lot. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
So, that change and how communities have been affected by those changes. My village, for example, Overseal, which we'll talk about in a bit, won't we? My village was, so it became an industrial village during the advent of industrialisation of the area, with coal mining, you know, mining for clay, factories, that kind of thing. It also, on its, that's on its eastern side over the Ashby Wolds where the clay and the coal measures were. On its western, it remained agricultural. So it's always had this sort of two-sided identity, but now it's become a, it's changed. There is no local, no, no local sort of industry and places to work in the numbers that we had before when, you know, 1,500 people would be employed at each individual mine, for example. Those kind of spaces, those kind of workplaces aren't there anymore. So what's the village become? Well, essentially, it's a dormitory village for people to get into their cars and drive into the West Midlands. Now, is that a good thing or a bad thing? I don't know. I don't judge that, but that's what it is. And that identity change is something that people haven't really absorbed yet because, you know, a forest takes a long time to grow, doesn't it? And so does identity take a long time to sort of adapt, I think, to that, that new way of life. And I think it's a generational thing. I think that'll be children who've not grown up with a, with an industrial past and only know the place for the beautiful space that it's become, won't remember the, you know, the miles of sucking clay that you used to have to wade through to get, you know, if you wanted to go for a walk. They don't remember that.
The open cast.
The open cast.
When we were at primary school.
Yeah.
I went to visit the open cast. You saw the big trucks with the tyres that were massive. You don't see that now.
No.
Now it's a golf course that they're building houses on.
Yeah, yeah. And, it'll be, and it will look lovely, and you will never know that that open cast mine was there.
Yeah.
And that's the same down the Trent Valley. You know, the gravel quarries that are there, actually, when they're put back and restored, they're very beautiful spaces that are given over to wildlife. So the industrial change has happened, but we've made it better afterwards. This is the Wildlife Trust I work for, you know.
That new old tip. We were at school. It was a big open tip, wasn't it? The big machinery moving all over it. My son, now 7, is never going to know that.
No.
All he ever sees when he drives past there is, walks past there is grass.
Yeah.
Wonders what the little chimneys are.
The methane pipes.
Wonders what they are. You have to explain that, but it's just green space to him now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. Yeah, the people will never know. Although, well, then.
You can find out.
You can find out,
you can't really begin to even imagine what a dump. Some parts of it were, some of it was. I mean, you look at some of the old newspaper reports and, you know, kids would get to school and they'd be covered in clay because there was clay everywhere, you know, wet clay on the pavements, on the roads, the front gardens. I remember driving through Albert Village and I used to think of it as a grey village because it was just clay dust was sprayed everywhere.
Wow. Yeah,
all up the houses when you used to, like, Spring Cottage Road and that
sort
of that
area. Yeah, same.
All up there.
Yeah.
Now it looks cleaner.
Yeah. So have we, are we returning to nature then? Is that what we're doing? Are we finding out the power of nature, and not through any kind of spiritual thing, but just in terms of actually it does impact our mental health, it does make people feel better, it does bring communities together, everyone's a bit more chilled when there's loads of nature about, and therefore there's a thing just come through about something being developed in Swadlincote, which is a new kind of green park area that they're going to put together,
right,
and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, are we really transitioning, or are we?
It'd be lovely to think, wouldn't it, that we've turned a corner.
Yeah.
And then you look at the news.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
we don't ever change. I think people, you know, we all know really what's best for us. But I'll give you an example. Last weekend, I was doing a geophysics study looking for a Roman road, which I think we found, by the way, but looking for it. And the River Trent, the Roman road comes from Leicester, cuts through north side of Overseal, through Linton, cross country to Drakelow, where it crosses the River Trent. Now, in what, AD 60, when the Roman League, the 9th Legion, arrived there, they built a camp, a fort there, because they were fearful of the Britons on the western side attacking them. On the opposite bank, built in 1940, is a pillbox designed to look east against the invading forces from the east. So nearly 2,000 years of history, and there's a fort one side and there's a pillbox the other.
That's
staring
incredible.
At each other. And you think, do we ever really change?
Mm.
I don't know. It'd be nice to think so, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
And to that end, that's what we've been working towards with building communities in along the Trent Valley with the job I've got now. But we specifically, I live in Overseal, always have done. So specifically, you know, building community in Overseal. And that's sort of what we were talking about when you came along and helped lay out the labyrinth and the orchard.
Mm. So that, yeah, let's start there then. That orchard, where did that come from?
So the orchard itself, I'd had an idea. I got a bit of a thing about orchards. They're beautiful things, and they've been grubbed up for years, haven't they? For the last how many decades? Certainly since the war, the Second World War, we've lost a massive percentage. I can't quote the number, but it's like in the region of 70% or 80% of the orchards across the country, certainly across sort of the West Midlands where they grow really well, and down to the south. They've all been grubbed out, and the ones that are left are they tend to be single species apple tree that are farmed on an industrial scale for cider production, for example. You know,
yeah.
So there's this bit of land that had been left over from development right in the heart of the village, and it was just a sort of bit of wasteland, really. You know, nobody really looked after it or cared for it. And I thought, well, there's an opportunity there. It was owned by. Still owned by the developer at that time, but it should have been handed over to the district council. So working with one of the district council officers, we managed to get that handed over to the district council, which meant then that Overseal Parish Council, because I am still on the council, could then do something with it, with a management scheme approved by the district council. So the scheme I put forward was that we would work with the parish council, the district council, the National Forest Company, and volunteers from the village to plant an orchard. Now the orchard is, we planted 31 trees because that's the amount of soldiers that were lost in the First and Second World War. So we gave it a meaning. So it became sort of a memorial orchard. But we also wanted to plant a variety of fruit trees. So it's not just apples, there's pears, there's plums, there's all sorts of, you know, there's a nut tree. And we wanted all of those to be pre-20th century heritage varieties. So it's now a heritage orchard and a memorial orchard. It's also a green space that people can go and just wander around. It's a community orchard so people can help themselves to the fruit when it's available. And then, well, we'll come on to the labyrinth in a bit, shall we? So it's a kind of palimpsest of things. It's all these accretions of layers of meaning that some people just go take the dog a walk around it. I knew that it'd been successful when I was in there one day, and there was an old lady. We'd put a little sitting bench in there, which was we need to go into that. It gets people hot under the collar, doesn't it? Benches where youths can gather, you know. They put in a little bench, and there was a lady in there. I saw her sitting on the bench. I said, "Oh, you're enjoying the sunshine?" She said, "Yeah, this is my, I think of this as my peaceful place." I thought, well, if we've done that for one person, and it's made a difference to one person's life, then it was worth it. It was worth the effort. And it's more than that, of course. It's become all sorts of things for all sorts of people. And I have seen youths in there, and they go in and they have a picnic and they gather all their things up and they put them in the bin. And I've seen the village drunks go in there and they'll drink their whatever it is they drink, and instead of chucking the cans on the floor, they gather them up and they put them in the bin. So they've got respect for the space. And I think that is part of the agency of the trees themselves and the space itself, you know. It acts on people.
So 31 trees spaced out in random spacing, or regimented?
So the space also, I ought to have mentioned, was a post-medieval gravel quarry on one side of it. So somebody in the past probably used the gravel that they quarried out to put onto the turnpike road, which is now the A444, which is evidently a hell of a route to travel then, because you needed to gravel it and it became a turnpike, and it's still a hell of a route to travel now because there's so much traffic on it. It divides the village in two. But so what we did, because it's got this sort of terraced effect, we planted 19 trees that represent the First World War soldiers at the top space, left a kind of open space, and then in the sort of the it's not a quarry, it dips down in a gentle terrace. We planted the 12 trees at the bottom there for that represent the soldiers from the Second World War. And then in the middle there's a kind of memorial stone, because it just so happened that the year we got that was also the centenary of the start of the First World War. So that added a sort of layer of meaning as well in there. So there's a marker stone that was carried, sculpted by a really talented local artist, Gary Williamson, who's an excellent painter, bowyer, sculptor, all those things that, you know, you envy yourself that people can do with their hands. You know, he's really good at all that kind of stuff. And he's created that. And again, the labyrinth, the big stone, that will be carved this year.
Brilliant.
That was my segue. I was going to use as well. Talking of stones,
yeah,
there's a labyrinth with a giant stone. I've seen the pictures.
Yeah, there is, yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, you spoke about there was a natural gap in the space that you created, and that gap is now filled. And it's filled, it's filled with a labyrinth.
It is, yeah. So I'd had this sort of vague interest in labyrinths for a long time. And we'd been to visit the one there's a Bronze Age rock carve. It's a carved labyrinth, carved onto a rock in Rocky Valley, of all places, in Cornwall. Mm. Right now, down near the sea. Me and Kay had been down to visit that in maybe 2015. And then we got talking to Willow and Rowan, and Willow said, well, do you know about the turf labyrinths? No, don't know anything about them. Well, it turns out that there are 8 remaining medieval turf labyrinths in the country. So Willow and Rowan took Kay and I over to visit the one at Wing in Leicestershire. It's the nearest one. And I was amazed by it. That's not really meant to be a pun. Because it's a labyrinth, not a maze. And the difference there is, a maze is where you go to be baffled and confused and get lost with false turns and not really knowing where you are, aren't it? And then a labyrinth is where it's only a single path, you cannot get lost. As you know, you've walked the Overseal one. You just follow the path to the centre. People use them for a variety of reasons, but you can't get lost, and it's a place I like to think where you go to find yourself, as a maze where you go to get lost.
And having walked it, you do. It's amazing. You know, for someone who may not be interested in maybe the more spiritual or magical or whatever you want to call it aspects of the labyrinth, actually is a simple meditation.
Mm.
You know, as a meditation, walking meditation from the outside to the inside and then back out again. It's fantastic,
isn't it?
And it really is.
People get different effects from it. I know that the term, when you walked it, Willow, you had, you know, it affected you in a particular way, didn't it?
Definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll say a bit about them in a minute if you
like. Yeah. So I'll just my first experience was when you came over, didn't you?
Yeah.
When we were marking it out, and we walked it as a painted line on the grass, and my overriding feeling, my overriding sensation when I arrived at the centre was one of joy, and this sort of laughter came bubbling out.
Mm.
And then when I walked it, when we completed it, it was the same.
Mm.
Gary, the sculptor, when he came, we put the stone in, and Gary said he'd like to walk it, and he did. And he was completely affected in a different way.
Mm.
Tears in his eyes, it had a very dramatic effect on his. And I don't know if that's something you take in there. You carry this stuff with you and let it go, or just the meditation of the purposeful walking.
Mm.
It's not. What it takes perhaps 5 minutes to walk it, depending on your pace, the speed of your pace. But you get different things from it, I think.
I think, yeah. Mine was just an absolute centeredness, a balance, and a calm.
Yeah.
That's what I got from it when I walked it. I've landed in the centre and went, yeah, everything's all right now.
Yeah.
And then walks out again.
Yeah, but I mean, I looked at Willow to talk a bit about it, because Willow introduced me to Turf Labyrinth, so, you know, you've known.
Shall I say hello then?
Yes.
Hello.
Yeah. So I've been hogging the mic.
Well, that's cool. It's good what you're saying. Yeah, I mean, I've been interested for a long, long time, most of my life, in earth mysteries, if you like, in connections to the land and that. And so labyrinth, stone circles, etc., etc., very interested in them. And one of the things that I think is that, unfortunately, people often think there's a dichotomy between spiritual and mystical things and like practical stuff. And this, in a sense, can bridge that, because it's very much rooted. It's not about all weird, let's put a cape on and do stuff like that. I mean, it can be if you want, but it's the people that originally created those. And I mean, the original ones, like, it's called a Troy Town Maze, mm-hmm. originally, and it dates right back to the Bronze Age and that sort of thing. People have been doing those, and they're a community thing. They're very much a community thing. And that's why it's nice to see it brought forward today. Because as you were saying earlier, we may be reappraising our connection with nature and moving slightly towards a green thing, although there's a long way to go.
Mm.
But one of the things that's happening, although this area is becoming lovely and green and all that kind of stuff, it's so beautiful now, is that communities have been fractured, and people have disappeared into the internet and into their bedrooms and their things and all that kind of stuff. And if stuff's going to be sustainable, it's not just enough to, you know, recycle some stuff and eat the right diet and that. There needs to be a way of people interacting with each other on a community level and that. And this is a profound, I would say, a profound act of magic to bring a labyrinth into a village like that. Labyrinths are an amazing thing, because they, one of the things I always feel when I go into one is I can't believe the distance it takes to go to it. It's, a lot of people think that they're, in a sense, it's the ultimate safe space. You're kind of weaving a pattern in there, and on one hand you're moving away from all the concerns of the outside world. On the other hand, you're drilling down or getting closer and closer to nature and stuff like that. When you get in the middle there, it's like a womb. It's like a safe space and things.
Mm.
And I've found when I've walked ones in quite noisy places, which thankfully the Overseal one doesn't tend to be, the level of sound, it's almost like there's some insulation somewhere. The sound levels change and you're in the middle there, and it's an incredible thing. So it is a very practical, down to earth thing, and I think this is one of the things, you know, unfortunately, with all the pagan and the Buffy stuff and all the stuff that's come on, and that there's been a kind of like, oh, this is a weird witchy thing and this is a practical thing, and in actual fact they amount to the same thing at the end of, at the end of the day. You know, people need to really get to feel nature, and like Mark says, trees are one of the awesome ways of doing that, and that's why the National Forest is a stunning act of magic in a way. Right, look what it's done, like you say. I mean, your descriptions of what the area was like and that, that is a big piece of will went into changing that.
Yes.
And it needs to continue and to build like that.
Yeah.
I mean, hopefully, you know, because it's a proper labyrinth that's been put in. It's not just a bit of mown grass like a few of them we've seen. I mean, this is a proper one. This is going to be there probably a long time after we're all gone. And
I hope so.
And that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And
well,
and
the one that you took us to at Wing.
At Wing, yeah.
Is perhaps 800 years.
Yeah.
It's been there.
Somewhere along those
lines. And then Kay and I went to the Julian's Bower. The one at Alkborough, where the Trent actually meets the Ouse and forms the Humber. And it overlooks that on a high escarpment. It's an absolutely stunning place. We walked there, Kay and I walked there in the rain, and it was worth every step. For, you know, and that's another thing we probably ought to talk about, the sort of the act of pilgrimage that a labyrinth is. And I realised some years ago, when you when we go to visit a stone circle, a standing stone, somewhere interesting like that, and it can be anything. It could be a church. It doesn't have to be like some kind of mystical pagan space. It can be anywhere of that interest, of that nature. To approach it on foot, and I would say for at least a mile beforehand, to give yourself that time to forget the, you know, the journey and the idiots on the M5 or whatever it might be, you know, and to walk into a kind of almost a meditative space and then discover these places. And then if there's a labyrinth at it, to then walk a labyrinth at the end of it is a kind of act of magic in itself. And it does have an effect on you. I wonder how it affects the world, though.
Yeah. But I think it's what you've just said. It's about agency, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mm.
In the through your whatever impact it has on you, and that it's through your subsequent actions, and yes. through your how that thing affects you, and how relaxed and chilled you are. That's going to affect how you then interact with the world around you afterwards. Yeah. If you want to look at it in a pragmatic way.
Absolutely. There's very much that side of it, isn't there?
Yeah.
Because, you know, it changes you, as you've just said. It might only change you for an hour, but I think not. I think I remember the first time we walked that labyrinth at the Wing Maze, as it's inappropriately titled. but it had an effect on me, and that effect has led to the creation of a new labyrinth in Overseal. So it had agency, didn't it? You know,
and people talk. I mean, one of the things I did as a job. I mean, I went and studied ecology and climate change and all that sort of stuff as well. And one of the big questions that resource managers were having to deal with at the time, and it's become more of a case, is about assigning a value. Yeah. To these things, right? You know, intangible value. I mean, the orchard in Overseal is worth zilch in terms of commercial stuff, but it has a huge value which will outlast. You know, if you think about putting on a commercial thing, you might do something, it might last a few years, whatever, it's gone. And that Overseal is now a village with a labyrinth, right? It's gone up a level, right? And people will. It's my firm belief that if we don't all exterminate ourselves sort of fairly quickly and things, that in the future, people will come. Oh, let's go and see the labyrinth. Let's go and see Overseal and things like that. So it links in with that. It has a huge value that you can't put pounds, shillings, and pence on. But in a sense, you need to sort of all bring that to the fore so that it's people understand that, because otherwise we're just at the prey of developers and that, who will just, you know, look at that bit of land and think, oh, I could put a house or two on there, you know. So somehow these things need to be quantified almost.
They do, and you're right. And I hate that idea of giving a monetary value to a thing that is invaluable.
Yeah.
But I appreciate sometimes that it has to be done.
Mm.
Because that's how people in positions of authority, they might have personal views that, you know, chime well with mine, but they also have to balance the books. So sometimes a monetary value has to be put onto a thing. It has to be commodified in some way, you know. Yeah. Something I really don't like about the world, and I resist when I can, but sometimes you just have to accept that if you need to talk to certain developers, for example, who individually, those people again might have very particular spiritual beliefs or whatever, but in their role in that job, that development company has to provide a return, doesn't it, on its so therefore they only understand things in that we only have a common language in commercial value of things.
And that space is different in value, I suppose, when they handed that to the district council. From a district council point of view, for them, it's just the space they've now got to manage. So potentially from their perception, the value is less than zero, because now it's a it's not an asset, it's a liability they've got to maintain.
Yes.
And the developer sees
that's
it as
right.
houses.
That's right. They see houses. They see something that there's a financial burden in some ways.
Yeah.
So, which is why we put together a management plan, so that we would take over that responsibility. And we manage that with volunteers. And those volunteers all come from the community, and they're not necessarily, you know, a lot of those people have moved into Overseal because of the green and beautiful place that it's become. But that is what Willow was talking about, the building that community, so people feel like they're part of something much bigger. They really feel like they belong in that place. Go on.
Sorry. I mean, to come up with a sustainable way of us all living together and that, there needs to be, you know, while part of the solution is always going to involve large agencies and things like that, a lot of it has got to revolve around people doing smaller initiatives locally and that kind of stuff. Things that build community, things to do with food security, for instance, you know, things to do with that. I mean, I'm not saying that we, you know, you're trying to feed Overseal with the orchard, but nonetheless, the simple act of realising that you could get a public space together, you could grow some fruit on it, and people can go and pick it and have it. It's like, wow.
Well,
you know,
free.
Yeah, it's free.
Help yourself.
What else could happen? And definitely, you know, there's hard times ahead financially and what have you. And the answers are not going to come from the big agencies or governments, ultimately. They're going to come from local community initiatives. How do we get together with the people around us and, you know, make life worth living around here and that sort of stuff.
And that ties into what Circularity do with the growing spaces, or, you know, the allotment sorts of places that you've got, doesn't it? You know, it's that having that space that you can connect with people, with the earth, and, you know, grow a thing, you know. And while we're talking about that, the orchard itself, we have a community apple day every October. And that is a thing to behold. Because 31 young trees don't produce much fruit. So what we said to people was, well, bring your own fruit from your own gardens, because a lot of it drops on the ground and it goes to waste and it rots. And yeah, it gets eaten by blackbirds and
wasps.
Things. But wasps, yeah. Wasps, yeah. But they bring their fruit.
What's the purpose? They don't have a job, do they? Wasps.
Wasps.
Sorry.
They're attracted to the apple and the value of the apple, I think. Yeah. But yeah, so we encourage people to bring their fruit from, and then there's a community effort goes in together where people chop the apples, put them into the scratter, which sort of mashes them into a pulp, and then go into the press where they're pressed and the juice is squozen out of them. Kids drink the juice fresh. There's a variety of different ciders that are then brewed across the village, and some of them are really quite good. You know, and that's created that kind of a different community spirit. And then we'll bring that to the wassail, which we have every year now in the orchard, and some of the cider then gets passed around. That's been made from, you know, the previous season's fruit crop from the village. So it's all this sort of like circular. I mean, it's not really a circular economy, is it? But it's this
it's
kind of circular mindset. Like that. This goes here, this goes there, this keeps going around, and we've got this. We've got this thing in motion, you know, and hopefully it'll outlast us.
That's the one, isn't it? There's loads we could jump off on here, which is like the idea of the act of doing something together. I got as a big thing from what you've both spoken about there.
Yeah.
And I was thinking just today, like me and. Andy had been at the library cleaning our van and getting it ready to go, you know, to be used in the local community. If I'd have had to do that on my own, I'd have hated every second of it.
Yeah.
You know, but the fact that I was doing it with somebody else and we were talking while we were doing it and I was learning from him, he's a very knowledgeable guy.
Yeah.
And we did it as part of a conversation and all that sort of stuff. Then it actually turned into something really sociable and enjoyable and something where when we got to the end of it, we both looked at the end product and went, well, look what we've achieved.
Yeah, you've done a thing together.
Yeah, that, exactly. Yeah, the simplicity is we've done a thing together. And that's with circularity, how it's worked with you and I, if there's a point where we've got to go off on our own and do stuff on our own, it almost can become quite painful, stressful. And but then you come together, you talk about it, you discuss it, and then the library. The amount of times we could have gone, no, sack it off, it's too hard.
Yeah, and it is hard, isn't it?
And it is hard. Yeah, yeah.
You know, like I could have created a labyrinth on my own with a spade and the barrow to put the granite dust in and all the rest of it. But actually, when there are 30 people, perhaps, throughout the course of a couple of days, all coming and joining in and all enjoying it, and you can see just the smiles on their faces and knowing that they've taken part in creating a thing that will outlast them. The orchard will continue to grow long after we're dead.
Yeah,
you know, the labyrinth may be there with, you know, touch wood, it might be there in 800 years time when we're completely forgotten. No one will know how that came about, who dug it, you know, who put it there and why. But it doesn't matter, it'll still be serving its function as a space for people to come and reconnect.
I've been coming to a slow realization during this podcast that as a child I was lied to.
Right.
Because the Minotaur can't have been in a labyrinth. Got to have been in a maze.
There wasn't
one way of getting there, was there? Yeah. Otherwise you wouldn't have been able to avoid it.
Yeah.
One way there, one way back.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Minotaur, though, there's a thing. There's a thing.
Oh, yes.
Right at the heart, the hero finds his way and defeats the Minotaur, doesn't he? So we're talking at all sorts of levels here, but really what's happened is it's the overcoming of death and the rebirth of life, isn't it? It's the, you walk in to the heart of the labyrinth, you find that centre, whatever it is, and you take it back out along the same path, and you end up in exactly the same place that you started from, but with something new, with something reborn. And I think that's the key to what a labyrinth is. It affects you on that level, and you have been lied to.
So I mean, if you think about the big old stone circles and sites like that, I mean, people go, oh, you know, what made people make these and all that, and you know you can talk about it, you can think about it, nobody knows exactly, but it was par excellence a community venture, right? People did that because it needed to happen, and when you go and visit them, there's a continuity there. You're thinking, yeah. You know, people are, like Mark said at the beginning of things, essentially the same. And that's a positive thing as well as
a negative
thing.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
People are essentially the same. And it can get all clouded up and lost because it seems all like a weird thing to be interested in or involved in. And it's actually not. It's like saying, you know, yeah, these people were there, other people were there, we're there, people will come after us, and all the while through that community and our relationship to the earth being tied to the earth.
That's the thread that links it, that sews it all together, isn't it?
Yeah.
So Stonehenge could have just been built by somebody who'd seen one, thought it was cool.
Yeah, let's have one of those.
I'm not gonna build one with the wood poles. Let's do something with stone.
Yeah.
Let's get it from Wales because I've got a bit of money. There's a few of us doing
Make
it.
Make it all worthwhile.
Yeah. Let's line it up with the sun because it looks cool in the morning.
I mean, our understanding of what times were like back then has changed so radically in my lifetime. I mean, you know, it was like cavemen walked around and biffed each other on the head, and then the Romans came and saved us, and civilization came from the Greeks and that sort of stuff. And now, you know, that's such arrant nonsense, and we know that. Not supposition, but enough archaeology and history has been done to show that the British Isles was a huge cultural interchange for a very long time. People from Europe would send, in the Druidic days, people would send their sons and daughters over here to learn stuff you know, because it was a place where of knowledge and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, the university equivalent of it.
Yeah.
And they could get here on the land bridge, couldn't they, at that time?
Getting on the land bridge, but the seas were where everything was as. I mean, we spent some time in the Orkneys, and you think of the Orkneys as being like, crash, you're stuck out in the middle of nowhere. They were such a cosmopolitan place in those days. People would come down and around and that, and you know, they've got brooches from Southern Europe and Africa and everything there.
Yeah.
You know, we have been lied to about, you know, where civilization started and what it is.
I think it kind of, I was thinking just as you were saying, it was very evident of the narrative of the ruling elite of the time is we're taking over these, what were they doing at that time? Taking over countries and seeing themselves as the saviours and saying that everybody there was before was savage.
Yeah.
So, well, we can trace ourselves, or at that point they were tracing themselves back to the Romans and going, well, the Romans came in and that's where we're kind of from, and they must have come in and just saved people because they must have just been savages before that point. And
well, that's always the ruling elite's narrative, isn't it?
Mm.
Whether that's the British Empire in the 19th century or the Roman Empire in the 1st century.
Yeah, but it's cultural, isn't it? And it's also, let me try this word out, egregorical. Mm. I've got really into the idea of egregore recently.
Mm.
And actually the idea of a country being an egregore, or the idea of a company being an egregore, and all of this energy being put into something specific that has...
Sorry to stop there.
Yeah.
I know what that means, but maybe some of our listeners don't.
it's a really hard thing to explain. You might be able to explain it better than I can.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
But it's basically like... It's something that then takes something that takes on a life of its own and becomes its own entity.
Mm.
It's probably the best way of describing it. Mm. So you can talk about it in a magical sense, you can talk about it in a spiritual sense in terms of demons and angels and things of that nature. But I've started tying this idea of an egregore to things that we create, just things that we create as humans. So it could be a company, it could be a country, it could be a band, it could be a club, it could be, you know, a concept. And actually, there's a point where this thing becomes its own entity. And it takes on a life of its own, and it stops being discrete parts, and it stops being individuals working, and it becomes this bigger thing, this thing you're talking about, that's bigger than the sum of its parts. Mm. And then when it becomes its own life form, it then begins to behave in its own way, and then attracts different things become attracted to it, and different things happen. And the thing that I found really interesting is the kind of energy that you put into an egregore is the kind of energy that then gets amplified. So if you're going in with a very empirical, even in business, if you're going in with that mindset of, right, we're going to create a massive company and take over all the other companies and we're going to be the best and we're going to, you know, make loads of money and all that, that's fine. But somewhere somebody's getting exploited.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's not going to work as a huge... If you come in at something with a more humanitarian angle, chances are you're not going to get individually rich off it. But what you're going to create in the world is something that then become something bigger that other people can plug into and become a part of.
How do you build a company like Amazon? Well, you don't build a company with that, like Amazon, by thinking about the people that are doing the job for you.
Yeah.
You build a company by exploiting people.
Yeah. I started learning from it just because I've become interested in that sort of stuff recently. But at the same time, I think you can apply that knowledge to the world we live in a particular way.
Yeah, definitely.
It feeds directly into some of the ideas behind labyrinths and that as well. A nice segue back into the labyrinth. Mm. Anybody that looks into any stuff about energy and will and that kind of stuff, which can be magical, spiritual things or whatever, one of the things that you learn pretty quickly is that life never moves in straight lines.
Mm.
It goes around. And you can put energy and will into something, and that can impel it to start, but it will never go to where you expect it to go. It's going to go somewhere. So somebody else or yourself needs to then go and give it another spin.
Yes, and that kind of spin stuff. Rather than it's not an arrow. Yeah.
But that's right, exactly. And it's the journey. I mean, it's cliche, but true. It's the journey that's the reality. I wrote a song about labyrinths, and it said the destination is illusion. It's the journey makes us whole.
Yes.
And that is the thing, and that sort of ties into this egregore idea and that as well, because that's the thing. You know, way back in the 60s, somebody said in a song, I won't quote now, but I'll just say, they say, effort and contrariness change the direction of fate. So it can be, we're not completely helpless and we're living in this time and there's nothing we can do. We can do stuff, but we don't need to be hung up on thinking we've got to get to that goal. What we've got to do is put the right energy into things.
And
it will move. The path is sure but never straight.
Indeed.
It's a labyrinth thing. That's the thing of it.
Yeah.
You know.